Chapter 15. Greg Abbott cares about Greg Abbott. Outside observers could be forgiven for thinking Greg Abbott leads Texas. Many governors made mistakes when it came to balancing human lives versus keeping capitalist enterprises humming. These were, forgive the cliche, unprecedented times, and some deference should be afforded. But none were so blatantly self-serving as Abbott, who abandoned any pretense that he was working to protect anything but his own political career. By design, Texas has a weak governor system. The long-standing joke goes that the most powerful person in Texas is actually the lieutenant governor, who controls the Senate and therefore the legislative agenda, and wields the power to quash or pass legislation that the governor may want. That's the system. But as both Abbott and his predecessor, Rick Perry, have shown, even a weak governor can consolidate immense power through personal relationships, moxie, and good old-fashioned nepotism, placing those indebted or loyal to him throughout the tentacles of the bureaucracy where they owe him, and he may call upon them. Abbott oversees the vast executive bureaucracy of a state that was once its own country, and sometimes still acts like one, with 29 million residents, the 10th largest economy in the world, a place where one can drive 14 hours straight and still be within its bounds, with state revenues of more than $250 billion a year. With his seat, Abbott has the influence to pick, prod, pressure, and push out agency heads who palm the levers of government and command some 500,000 government workers. Those agencies include the enormous Health and Human Services Commission, the state's equally troubled iteration of the federal HHS. Add to that education, the state police and Texas Rangers, insurance, public utilities, emergency management, the child welfare system, and more. While Abbott is charged with directing this unwieldy bureaucracy, insiders often describe his disinterest in it or how it works. His interest, I'd hear over and again, had to be spurred by an inconvenient headline. And when things go awry, he would blame whichever bureaucracy oversaw said cock-up and push somebody out of a job. In this way, he wears his crown without the weight. As a former reporter for the Austin American-Statesman and the Dallas Morning News, I covered Abbott's entire first term and some of his second. And while reporters in Austin shy away from this phrase, I came to refer to the apparatus as the Abbott administration, for he works his executive branch in much the same way as a president. Thus, Abbott should be held accountable for how he wields this power, just as legions of D.C. press corps reporters hover around the machinations of the executive branch of the federal government. But despite a robust and talented group of reporters in the state capitol, Abbott expertly evades consequential scrutiny of his administration's mistakes and failures, which are numerous. I marveled as many definitive and damning exposés from the state's powerhouse newspapers bounced right off him. Everything from government waste, political patronage and nepotism, systemic neglect of disabled and abused children, to purging Hispanic names from voter rolls, and more. In that time, I came to believe Abbott's Teflon is created from a shrewd understanding that it ain't really Texans to whom he is accountable. Hell, it's not even the finely curated electorate that voter suppression measures and gerrymandering have afforded his controlling party, despite demographics that are hewing blue. No, Abbott has consistently shown, with such predictability that it's almost boring, that he holds himself accountable to the right-wing media, and by extension, those who use it to force his hand. I first observed this trend in 2015, during Operation Jade Helm 15, a routine exercise led by the Pentagon to place soldiers in unfamiliar terrain and train them to better navigate social and economic conditions in conflict zones. For 8 weeks that summer, the operation took place in Texas and six other states. But what was a routine military exercise also happened to be a routine exercise under President Barack Obama's leadership, to which Texas and many Texans were openly hostile. Abbott had gained notoriety in his previous elected seat, Texas Attorney General, by suing the Obama administration more than 30 times, focusing on issues that could be a Mad Libs Fox News edition party game. Immigration, the Affordable Care Act, climate change, drilling, and more. The influx of soldiers to communities of folks prone to conspiracy ideology created a statewide hubbub, including in a community outside of Austin that had been beaten down by natural disasters and disillusioned by inadequate government response. I was sent to Bastrop County to report the story after residents whooped and booed and lobbed angry questions during a county commissioner's meeting that was called to address rumors that the exercise was a martial law takeover. One attendee held up a sign that read, "No Gestapo in Bastropo." It was stupid. Much of the hysteria was stoked by Alex Jones, the Austin-based talk radio host and millionaire whose website, Infowars.com, regales its audience with tales of the merely absurd, such as that lizard people exist and chemicals in the water are turning frogs gay, to far more damaging and outrageous lies, like the claim that the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, which left 26 dead, including 20 children, was a hoax. In his unbearable way, Jones and others spread fear that Jade Helm was a precursor to the martial law takeover of the United States at the direction of Obama. A sort of Trojan horse. Military training in Texas, a bastion of military jingoism, was suddenly and inexplicably controversial. Such folderol could be expected to dissipate, but in one of his first acts as governor, Abbott validated the fringe of his party and the rampant conspiracy theories spreading online. He ordered the Texas State Guard to monitor the situation, that is, somehow watch over the Pentagon, to address concerns of Texas citizens and to ensure that Texas communities remain safe, secure, and informed. The governor's action, which he later downplayed, attracted troubling responses from Texans, including some that would echo sentiments leading to the insurrection of January 6, 2021. One citizen wrote in typo-laden caps, "It wouldn't surprise me if Obama called for martial law in order to stop the next election from taking place. So thank, sir, for taking care of Texas." Abbott is not Trump. Though he's been described by political insiders as a bully, he lacks the bluster of Trump, and he's sharp enough to lob most of his barbs behind closed doors. For Texas, he's low-key compared to some of his predecessors. Therefore, back in his first year as governor, local pundits and academics were bewildered as to why such a smart and accomplished legal professional waded into the Jade Helm bog. But the saga revealed a political style that would be less than amusing during a pandemic. He will always shoot for short-term political gain and minimum disruption within his Republican network, and he'll backtrack later if necessary. Time and again, Abbott has followed this playbook. In 2017, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the most powerful politician in Texas, seized on a different hysteria and proposed a so-called bathroom bill that barred transgender students in schools from using bathrooms corresponding to their gender identity. This gave Patrick, a former conservative radio host, a huge spotlight that he knows well how to wear. But even the most conservative business people and groups didn't want the bill to become law because it threatened to deter businesses, some of which had vowed to leave or change plans to relocate in Texas. This bill was such a hot potato that liberal advocacy groups found themselves bedfellows with the likes of Texas oil companies and powerful conservative business groups. The establishment, including Abbott, wanted the bill to die. Abbott could have promised to veto the bill, saving his state the embarrassment and political backlash. But he instead tacitly endorsed it, hoping the measure would blow up before he was forced to make a decision. More specifically, a decision that could put him in the crosshairs of Patrick, the right-wing media, and constituents that consume it. He chose instead to leave it to the Speaker of the House to kill the bill, a move that contributed to that longtime House leader's loss of favor within party ranks before he retired from public office. Sarah Davis, a Republican and former state House member, says Abbott never forged relationships in the Texas Capitol to direct actual policy or diffuse such a hot-button issue before it could become a legitimate legislative effort. That's probably because, in 7 years, he hadn't revealed much of a policy agenda at all. Other than staying in office, even Republican politicos strain to understand what Abbott actually wants to accomplish. Abbott has spent most of his attention on fundraising, campaigning, and putting Texas on Fox News chyrons. And he's good at it. I remember him being largely disengaged with the legislature, Davis, who represented a Houston suburb, told me. With Abbott's carrot wanting, legislative members learned to fear his stick. That's what Davis got at the end of the 2017 legislative session, just before the start of a special session that Patrick had forced Abbott to call to keep the bathroom bill alive. During a sparsely attended press conference, Davis called the governor out for not adding ethics reform bills to the special session agenda. Davis oversaw a couple of committees, but wasn't much of a power broker, because she stood with Democrats on abortion. Abbott could have easily ignored the conference, but she had touched a nerve. Abbott put Davis on his shit list. To kick her out of politics, he would eventually use his powerful endorsement and money from his formidable campaign war chest to support Davis's competition in the next Republican primary. Davis managed to win nonetheless. "I thought, man, that escalated quickly," Davis joked. "I'm no threat to Greg Abbott, but the fact that he perceived me as a major threat to expend so much time and energy, it tells you something." Davis says the governor's decision-making is driven by paranoia, of Patrick's ability to change the message, of dissent within his Republican ranks, of anyone who might challenge him in public. Perhaps most telling, in the next election cycle, when an anti-Trump wave threatened to hurt Republicans down ballot, casting the party's control of the state house in jeopardy and thereby threatening Abbott's best buffer against Patrick and his acolytes, Abbott endorsed Davis. "He spends $250,000 to defeat me in one cycle, and then the very next cycle he endorses me. Why? Not because I asked for it. I didn't. It was because there was so much concern that he was going to lose the house, and he couldn't have that on his watch," she said. Greg Abbott cares about Greg Abbott. Fast forward to 2020, Abbott's second term. As other states began to lock down, Patrick went on the offensive against lockdowns, essentially suggesting we ought to let elderly Americans die in order to keep the economy, Trump's best argument for re-election, running along. "Those of us who are 70-plus, we'll take care of ourselves, but don't sacrifice the country," Patrick, who was about to turn 70, said during a conversation with Fox News' Tucker Carlson in late March. "No one reached out to me and said, 'As a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that America loves for its children and grandchildren?' And if that is the exchange, I'm all in," Patrick said. Despite that painful grammatical syntax, the message was clear. Don't sacrifice commerce. Sacrifice grandma. So, briefly, I and other Abbott observers were surprised in early April 2020 when Abbott ordered what amounted to a lockdown of all non-essential business in Texas. His was one of the last states to do it, but still, it was an act in the public interest, and one in which a huge chunk of the public wasn't interested. Ordering a Texan to stay at home would, on principle, require some diehard Texans to leave home, I suppose. He instead referred to it as an essential services and activities only order, which caused instant confusion for residents and business owners who couldn't discern what his order did. As local governments tried to wade through the order, reconciling it with, for instance, mask mandates already enacted in many cities, Abbott clarified. His order superseded any local ordinance. In effect, cities and counties couldn't require citizens to wear masks, the simplest and easiest way for individuals to slow the spread and save lives. Abbott was in charge under emergency declaration orders, and the legislature, which is supposed to provide a check on his power but seldom does, was out of session. They meet only every 2 years, a convenient buffer for lawmakers who can escape the ire of a public that has the attention span for only the most recent Texas scandals, which occur with impressive frequency. What Abbott didn't explain, among other things, was that his order did allow local governments to force businesses to require masks and endowed municipalities with the power to fine business for non-compliance, a loophole that took overwhelmed locals months to exploit for the benefit of their populace. When the top manager of Bexar County, which includes San Antonio, finally ordered mask wearing in private businesses, Abbott expressed amusement that the county judge finally figured that out. Abbott was like, "Well, you finally figured it out," Davis remembers. Like it's a fucking riddle. The governor's office did not respond to my requests for an interview. Still, the non-lockdown lockdown, despite its mealy-mouthed execution and subsequent confusion, was likely successful in tamping down the rise of confirmed cases and avoiding some of the terror seen in the first waves in New York City and Seattle, for instance. Texas found itself in the same uneasy social contract as other states, asking individuals to make sacrifices to give the government time to get its shit together. But Abbott faced continuous pressure to rescind his orders from his right flank, especially from Patrick. In late April, Patrick used the Fox News bullhorn to double down on his logic, telling Tucker Carlson, "I don't want to die. Nobody wants to die. But man, we've got to take some risks and get back in the game and get this country back up and running." On April 29th, the day before Abbott allowed restaurants, movie theaters, and stores to open at 25% capacity, Texas set a daily record for COVID-19 deaths, 50 dead in one day, and more than 1,000 others testing positive. Those numbers would soon seem morbidly quaint. In the first week of May, reporters at the Daily Beast and an Austin political newsletter got their hands on a recording that showed Abbott precisely understood the consequences of giving in to the pressure. "How do we know reopening businesses won't result in faster spread of more cases of COVID-19? Abbott rhetorically asked during a conference call with state lawmakers and members of Congress. "Listen, the fact of the matter is pretty much every scientific and medical report shows that whenever you have a reopening, whether you want to call it a reopening of business or of just a reopening of society, in the aftermath of something like this, it actually will lead to an increase in spread. It's almost ipso facto." Ipso facto. The same day Abbott's eyes-open analysis was laid bare, a Dallas salon owner named Shelley Luther was sentenced to a week in jail and fined $7,000 for having defied the governor's order to close non-essential businesses. If you think the law is more important than kids getting fed, then please go ahead, Luther told a state district judge, while omitting that her business had been a recipient of small business loans to keep her kids fed and businesses such as hers afloat. The story blew up, and Luther became a Fox News folk hero. In a stroke of political genius, Patrick paid her fine. Abbott had been embarrassed by the defiance of a constituent who personified the Texas spirit to which he panders. She had big hair, dances and sings, wears cowboy boots. She ripped up the judge's cease and desist order and dared police to come and take her. It was something to behold. Abbott had rocked the boat with something approaching decisive action, so to steady it that same week, he nullified the enforcement provision in his order. Luther and a couple of other salon operators were set free. Throwing Texans in jail who have had their businesses shut down through no fault of their own is nonsensical, and I will not allow it to happen, Abbott said in a press release, announcing changes to his own executive order. If Abbott had a dog in the fight against the virus, he'd just neutered it in public. COVID-19 had not gone away. Cases were rising, and despite earlier proclamations that he'd wait to see if the first round of limited openings had led to a rise in cases, and following the embarrassment of the so-called rebel salon queen, Abbott decided to speed up the reopening, to the pleasure of his far-right Republican critics. Luther, by now a famous and formidable critic of Abbott's handling of the pandemic, launched a campaign for the Texas Senate. Abbott would endorse Luther's competition and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars from his own campaign funds to help defeat her. I think that it affected Greg Abbott greatly, Davis said of the salon saga and Patrick's handiwork. I think that Abbott has very thin skin. The mixed messaging, backtracking, obfuscation, and kowtowing belied the steady and sure aura of a governor who had shown strong leadership during Hurricane Harvey a couple of years before, when Texas gave an impressive display of tough, and even, weirdly, common interest. Chris Hooks, a Texas Monthly magazine writer who has dogged Abbott for years with trenchant writing and, in easier times, lots of sarcasm, offered the clearest indictment of Abbott's leadership that I've seen. Texans are now discovering what lawmakers saw in Abbott during that first legislative session, an unwillingness to communicate clearly and a tendency to seek the most politically expedient position, particularly when confronted by the Republican Party's right wing. Neither of those qualities is a good match for a public health crisis. By the first week of June, following a series of orders relaxing his earlier orders that limited public gatherings and business operations, his state had become a hotspot. Abbott opened the state ahead of infection rate goals he had publicly set for himself. Deaths had surpassed 1,700 and were rising at an alarming clip. Hospitals were filling up fast. The messaging, the rules for what is safe and what is not, remained fuzzy. Few people outside liberal city centers could be seen wearing masks. Abbott was still refusing to issue a mask mandate. I want to give the benefit of the doubt, said Davis, who lost her state House seat to a Democrat in 2020. No governor wants the blood of their constituents on their hands. But we know he reopened before meeting those metrics. That's purely political. As Abbott predicted in that phone call obtained by the Daily Beast, when lockdown restrictions eased, COVID cases increased. If he had finished the thought to its logical conclusion, it might have gone something like this. As cases increase, more people will die. Ipso facto.